Welcome to week four of digital curation. This week we'll be examining various aspects of born digital materials. I think it's undeniable that today we're surrounded by digital communications, digital devices, digital records, everywhere, all the time, throughout our day. And many observers have argued that we're in the midst of a major media revolution comparable to the introduction of the printing press. I concur with this. I would also say that I think that it's the revolution we're in the midst of is analogous to another more subtle revolution that took place or has taken place in many societies, moving from oral records to digital records as the preferred or privileged medium for record keeping. In Europe, this took place over a number of centuries, culminating probably around the late 18th century, where written records began to be legally privileged over oral records. In the vernacular, what this meant was that a man's word was worth less than the written record, and a man's word or a woman's word in most societies is greatly valued, but especially in predominantly oral societies. To look at the analogy though with the printing press. Let's remember that the printing press was introduced centuries ago, and it took several centuries before it reached its full potential in terms of creating new genres of documents, new forms of communication, and so forth. The immediate result was that the hand copying of books was replaced with printing books, but they were used more or less in the same way. And this is pretty standard. When a new medium is introduced, it tends to be used in the same way as the medium that people were used to before that. So it took several centuries and also a rising level of literacy in Europe before you began to see the emergence of new genres like newspapers, magazines, even greeting cards, catalogs, and broadsides might be seen as new document genres. Looking at the shift from oral to written records, as I said, this took place, didn't take place at the beginning of writing or the beginning of written records in Europe or anywhere else. This was really an evolution of trust over a long period of time. And I would argue that we have some ways to go in terms of reaching the same level of trust with digital records that we have with paper records, although some progress has been made. Now, if we look at the shift from analog to digital, and however we want to date the digital revolution, it's been around for a number of decades. If we go to the beginning of computers or the beginning of the internet even, we still have several decades of evolution. Some of us, like myself, are digital immigrants who have observed in our lifetime the changes from analog to digital. Others are digital natives. They've grown up with digital communications. But regardless, all of us have observed and are observing ongoing change, because I think the nature of the digital shift is an increasing rapidity of change with new communication modalities and new document types being invented and used very quickly. The initial shift, however, mirrored to a large extent what happened with the printing revolution. Digital media were used to perform analog tasks, albeit more quickly, more efficiently, probably cheaper. For example, word processing replaced the typewriter. Databases displaced hand tabulation of data accounting systems replaced the handwritten transactions and manual tabulations that were done earlier. The key here, I think, is that these programs, for these programs, the record was still paper. And if you've seen the old print-offs from 1970s and 1980s, the computer data with the big long sheets, you'll know what I'm talking about. That is what was kept, and the data was discarded after the record was created. Similarly, with word process documents, the digital document was the processing document, and the record copy was the paper copy. Now, I would suggest that those have, since that time, been inverted. It's much more likely now that the digital copy will be the record copy, and the paper copy is the one that people edit on by hand and perhaps discard, perhaps save after the fact, but that would not be the final copy. So I would argue that a second generation of digital work began with email, although not right at the beginning of email. It took some time. Email was initially modeled after the memorandum, and it was set up for scientists on big science projects to leave little notes to each other about their observations on shared data. However, email took on a life of its own, or rather, I should say, it was put to different uses by the users of email. They began to use it for more casual conversational communications. Since it lacked any of the social context cues of face-to-face or telephone conversations, they invented emoticons to avoid misunderstandings and also to convey more subtle communications than text allows for. In the mid-1980s, the meme format expanded the use of email further, allowing the inclusion of audio, still, and moving images, and various other kinds of attachments. With increasingly widespread use of email in the late 1980s, and especially after the internet was opened for commercial use in the early 1990s, email became a widely used new medium that had transcended its analog roots. On a smaller scale, but within the same rough time frame, chat, which had been developed on dial-up electronic bulletin boards in the 1980s, emerged as a mode of synchronous communication, though it was not as widely used and still is not as widely used as email. The shift from paper to electronic has been underway for some time and is still very much in process. A lot of work has been done by vendors to create secure environments for commercial transactions, and both government agencies and businesses have worked hard to create record-keeping systems that record transactions in reliable ways. Accounting systems are a good example of that. Yet many people, especially older ones, do not trust these systems very much. And the web is just beginning to develop the kind of warranting structures that help people to distinguish between reliable and unreliable sources. So appropriately, I would argue, there are varying degrees of trust about information circulating on the internet. Now, by warranting structures, I mean the types of visual and other aids that assist us in assessing the reliability of a source. For example, in the paper world, if you had a book from Harvard University Press, and it had a well-designed cover, it had nice paper, well-designed book, well-written, and so forth. These are all clues that it's probably been vetted to experts, edited, and was probably more reliable than a self-published book without those qualities, without a well-designed cover, and so forth. We're starting to get there in the web world, in the sense that a well-designed website does take some skill and probably some resources to create now. It was not like that in the beginning of the web, where static web pages were the norm. However, it, you know, at the beginning of the web, people were very worried that anybody could put up, for example, a Harvard University website and call themselves Harvard and be taken as credible as a result. We've moved away from that, but there's still a lot of gray out there on the internet, and I think we have a ways to go in terms of warranting structures that are comparable to the analog world. There are wide areas of digital documentation in which there are, I would argue, appropriately varying degrees of trust. Just ask yourself, do you believe everything you read on the internet? And if not, how do you distinguish between what's reliable and what's not? Now, taking a look at the digital universe, as I call it today, I would like to examine this population of digital documentation through some traditional library and archival models, primarily to show where they fall down in the digital world. Traditional library and archival approaches to documentation divide materials primarily by source, in the case of archives, that is, archivists collect records of an institution or papers of individuals, and that's the primary division of materials. Libraries collect primarily by document genre, for example, books, serials, maps, and so forth. Now, after that, they may divide by subject, title, author, or at least tag these materials in their cataloging records by those criteria. But document genre is the primary means of division. I would argue that these fail to encompass the universe of digital documentation. Furthermore, they do not adequately account for the changes in existing records that occurred in the transition from analog to digital. In addition to changing record-keeping formats, the digital shift has introduced numerous new modes of communication, modalities that have changed the way collaborative work is done, thereby changed the records generated by it. We've already talked, or at least mentioned, email and chat, but there are various programs that facilitate group work similar to the Moodle program we were using for this class. There's texting, there's Skype, and there's a plethora of social media. Although social media are not extensively used in the workplace as of yet, this may well change as the generation that has grown up with them enters the workforce. All of these modalities offer the possibility of capturing types of communication that would not have been captured in the past. For example, in looking at the records of a meeting in an organization, in the paper world, you might find two copies of the minutes of a meeting, the draft with comments by some of those present, and the final copy. With digital files, you might find 15 versions of the minutes, as many emails recommending changes to them, as well as numerous emails in which the subject of the meeting was discussed in great detail. You may also find that they're all deleted, but assuming that they are there, what do you keep? My own argument is that it is important to retain email with substantive policy discussions, because that is precisely what is needed to go back and determine why something was done, and for that matter, who actually authorized it. People tend to be more frank in emails than they are in communications on paper. As you probably know, bureaucratic writing is designed to hide as much as it reveals. Hide all of the human nuances of communication, hide any personal differences between staff and so forth. Email, though, is seen as a more oral communication in practice. It's used as a more oral communication in practice, at least. And this is why attorneys who are doing discovery for litigation always want to be able to search the email. That's where they find the little juicy pieces of information that incriminate their opponent. Now, looking at personal papers, you might also find multiple versions of various things the person has written. If you are lucky, you might have some of the person's emails as well. However, you are unlikely to have a lot of things to document that person's life. Social media accounts of various kinds, for example, or digital financial transactions, and so forth. In libraries, you would find digital publications of all types, especially those that mimic analog publications, such as books, magazines, newspapers, and so forth. But what about websites, role-playing games, and various social media? I should note that the Library of Congress has made the commitment to archive the entirety of Twitter, so they are moving out of the traditional library mode in so doing, and there have been other national libraries that have done similar things on a national scale. The National Library of Australia in particular. I would argue that users of new media have created a multitude of new discourses not found in the analog world, both one-to-many, in other words, broadcast media, one-to-one, private media, and many-to-many, which are things like forums and various interactive modalities. Except for the one-to-one communications, these comprise a category I would call digital public discourse. And this does not fit well with previous library and archival paradigms. It might include online fora, websites, blogs, social media, digital art, game playing sites, and so forth. Now I'd like to talk for a minute about the characteristics of the various digital materials. I should perhaps note at this point the discussions that occur in the digital curation literature about digital documents versus digital objects. I tend to like to use documents and perhaps stretch the paradigm of what a document is. In my view, digital objects might include executable files, which I don't include as a document. But the problem is that going from analog to digital has created some problems with applying the model of what a document is, and so a lot of digital curators and allied professionals have started using the term digital documents. So let me offer a working definition of document here that is what I intend by it, and we can go from there. By document, I mean very simply an object that fits into a socially constructed document genre, such as a blog. If there's an identifiable genre, it's a document. This construct helps to mediate the meaning of the content of the document. Almost everything digital does fit into a document genre, I would argue, but still some prefer the term digital object. Please note, though, that the digital document is not synonymous with digital files. A document may be composed of multiple files, and so we should make that distinction. Moving beyond documents, there are things that I'm starting to call traces. They appear in other kinds of record-keeping systems and other documents. Traces would be, for example, cookies, favorites, likes on Facebook, maybe even financial transactions. Things where you're leaving a trace behind, but it doesn't necessarily appear in your own records. Then there are also digital records that are created by machines without any human intervention, such as data flight recorders. Those are also part of the digital world. And I should say that the digital world is made up of a wide variety of materials with varying degrees of reliability and authenticity. Remember that that this includes a lot of material posted anonymously. There's also a great deal of redundancy, multiple copies and multiple versions of materials may be found in various sites, but also even within the same set of records. And so there are some new issues to deal with when we get into the collecting phase. Finally, and I think this is a really important point, the digital world is not composed simply of information. And further, I would argue, documents are not simply wrappers for information. They are not just information carriers. The components constitute records of what some have called communicative action. And this is to say that communication isn't simply conveying of information. It never is, or rarely is. You may be directed to do something, you may be asked to do something, you may be conveying your feelings to someone. These are not just, conveying information. In the field of digital records, for example, property records and financial transactions are recorded digitally, and they can convey rights and obligations that have the force of law behind them. They're not just pieces of information. An email from your boss telling you what to do is not just sharing information about his wishes or her wishes. He's expecting some action to result from that communication. A flame war on a listserv is usually an attempt to either enforce or alter unwritten rules of discussion. And likewise, various types of social interactions are now communicated digitally and become part of the existing digital documentation, but they are not simply sharing of information. They are intended to do more than just share information. I think that's important to bear in mind. These different types of functions may well be the critical piece of information in assessing what should be collected and what should not. So finally, let me just ask, who's creating all this documentation? Where is it? And, hopefully, where can we capture it? To begin with, we can say with some certainty that most of it is personal. Most of it is created by individuals. Several studies have shown that 75 to 80% of documentation in the digital world is created by individuals. I've assigned one of those studies to you. It's a bit dated, but it's still relevant. That is, most would fit into the traditional category of personal papers in using current archival paradigms. At the same time, however, and this is where I think you see the paradigms really fall down, 80% of this personal documentation is controlled by private corporations, not the individuals. Thus, it is possible to capture only about 20% of the documentation using the traditional archival model. The rest would be scattered in various privately controlled sites of various kinds, social media and so forth. And then the remainder of the digital documentation, of course, is created by institutions of various kinds, government agencies, businesses, nonprofits, and so forth. So in summary, I'd just like to say that there's a huge and rapidly growing body of documentation out there. It offers great potential for documenting areas of society that have been neglected traditionally, but also the possibility for massive loss of records if effective means of capture is not developed. These materials are extremely diverse, and I should say they will continue to become even more diverse. It changes the order of the day, I think, in digital curation. And one of our jobs as digital curators will be figuring out a way to separate the wheat from the chaff in the digital records. Thank you.